Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'm going to put some context around the numbers, perspective around politics, and clarity around choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Max. Coming up on our program today, miss the deadline and face the consequences as benefit fund enforcement tightens on employers. The sugar tax is back in the spotlight as the health lobby turns up the pressure ahead of the budget. Indian-built cars flooding the market and raising fresh questions about South Africa's auto future, and an 88% matric pass rate, but the education system is still leaking learners. It's Thursday, the 22nd of January. Now, pay late and the consequences just got a lot more serious for employers. A quiet regulatory change in January now means late or unpaid benefit fund contributions can trigger action from both labour inspectors and financial regulators, with criminal liability firmly on the table. So I want to discuss what has changed, why it matters, and what employers need to do right now. In that respect, from the law firm Weber Wenzel, I'm joined by partner Nicolette van Vuren. Nicolette, a very warm welcome. So what exactly has changed this month, and why is this a big deal than many employers maybe realize?
So we've always had, from a pension fund perspective, regulation from the Financial Sector Conduct Authority. Although they didn't have actual regulation over the employers, they could name and shame. They went to court to get personal liability for directors in instances where there was arrear contributions. But what has changed now is that the Minister of Labour has actually now made Section 34A of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act applicable to employers who contribute to retirement funds that are governed by the Pension Funds Act. And what that means is that they are now making sure that contributions are paid over within a certain period, that being 7 days after the deduction from members, and if the employer is making a contribution, 7 days after the month in which they are due. So now the inspectors, from a labour perspective, are going to have regulatory authority over those employers, where in the past they haven't had that.
What drove the decision, do you think, to change this? Where were employers being tardy, and was it a widespread problem?
Look, we've seen basically in the private security sector that employers haven't been paying contributions over. And so when the two-pot system came into being, members actually started seeing that these contributions hadn't been paid over because they wanted to withdraw and they couldn't because they were arrear contributions. So to make sure that there was more regulation over employers, I know the EFF went and approached the minister, and based on meetings that they've had, the minister has now decided to make sure that Section 34A is now applicable.
Nicolette, the seven-day payment rule sounds simple, but the trigger dates, as I read it, can differ. Where do you think employers then are most likely to trip up in practice?
Look, they've always had, I mean, in terms of the Pension Funds Act, they have to pay over within 7 days after the month in which the contributions are due. So in other words, if they're due for the month of January, they've got to pay by the 7th of February. With this new amendment, once they deduct from the employee's salary, they have 7 days to pay over. So if your payment date is the 25th of the month, they have 7 days from the 25th of the month. Whereas if there's only an employer contribution, in other words, they're not deducting from the salary, they can pay within 7 days from the end of the month. So I think that is going to be the problem. I mean, it sounds minuscule, the time period, but I think that is where the problem is going to come in. They're going to deduct those contributions, and in employers' minds, they may think that they only have 7 days from the end of the month to pay over, whereas that period may be shorter because they deducted before the end of the month.
There's not dual enforcement as far as this is concerned, but as in everything, is there the capacity to actually exercise that and make sure that people are applying or complying with the law?
Yeah, I think from a labor perspective, we do see compliance orders issued often. So, you know, I think where a member or an employee reports it to the Department of Labor, I think we are going to see regulation from the Department of Labor. From the FSCA point of view, I think they can just really carry on doing what they have been doing, which is basically naming and shaming. Funds could get more involved and approach the courts to enforce personal liability against directors. But I do think we're going to see more from a labor perspective where the inspectors are now going to start issuing compliance notices.
Directors and senior managers can now be personally liable. What does it mean then for boards and executives who assume often that payroll is someone else's problem?
Yeah, that's quite a good question. We saw last year in the High Court in Cape Town issued a judgment where the directors were held personally liable. And in fact, the defences that those directors used, well, we actually only oversee the company. We don't get involved in the management of the financial affairs. But the court said, well, you're a director. You should be overseeing every aspect of the business, and therefore you are personally liable. So the courts are really not taking any excuses from directors. They're saying you managing and overseeing it, therefore you are personally liable.
So what are the worst case consequences that employers then should understand, whether it's criminal sanction or even fines?
So, look, I mean, from a FSCA perspective, the Pension Funds Act does have severe consequences. We don't really see those happening in the industry at the moment. Criminal charges can be laid. And the funds, the FSCA is taking a different approach. They would rather work with employers to ensure that the members are in a good position and their interests are protected rather than issuing fines at the employer probably can't afford in any event. So we haven't really seen those fines issued. There are fines of up to 10 million rand and imprisonment, but the FSCA is rather working with the employers to ensure that the members have those amounts and the benefits in their retirement savings.
So if you had to recommend one immediate action to employers this week to reduce risk, what would it be?
Diarize and make sure that your payroll systems are properly implemented to ensure that those contributions are paid over within the 7 days of deducting them from members. Ordinarily, they would have paid them over within the 7 days after the end of the month, but I think that is where the critical aspect is going to come in, that employers need to pay over within 7 days from deducting.
Nicolette van Vuren from Weber Wentzel, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
Diabetes is costing South Africa lives, limbs, and billions of rand, and much of it is preventable. With the budget speech just weeks away now, the fight over the health promotion levy is intensifying, and it's pitting public health evidence against industry pressure. And at the center of this battle is a call to raise the sugar tax from 11 to 20%. I want to talk about that in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Nzama Mbalati, who's Chief Executive Officer of the Healthy Living Alliance. Nzama, opponents say a higher sugar tax hurts consumers. You argue it saves lives. Why should government prioritize this now, in your opinion, amid the ongoing cost of living pressure that we're all feeling?
So I think we have to look at this issue from many aspects in terms of the health promotion levy. One is an important tool to protect citizens, you know, from overconsumption of sugar. But we shouldn't just penalize people. We've been saying this money should be soft ring fence into initiatives that actually make people to afford, you know, most of the staple foods that we eat daily. And I think there are many ways in which we can progressively use the health promotion levy, even the sugar industry itself, to look at, you know, diversification, right? And ways to improve, you know, crop production and using sugar for non-consumption, for non-human consumption, as such as biofuel. So we're thinking there is, as the aim of the health promotion levy, spin-offs of wins in terms of like implementing the health promotion levy. We have a growing epidemic of diabetes. We cannot ignore it anymore. So I think it's no longer an issue of Who do we choose? I think it's looking at it in a more holistic way in responding to non-communicable disease and diabetes in particular.
You're calling for a jump from 11 to 20%. Why is the current levy not enough? And is there any evidence that you have that shows this increase would actually change any kind of behavior?
Very good question. So one of the things we know is that the research that was actually released by the World Health Organization recently shows that particularly the big manufacturers of sugary drinks have a way of keeping these sugary drinks more cheaper to scale up consumption amongst the population. And I think we know that, you know, stifling the taxation, which the aim was actually to put the cost more and more unaffordable. If this tax is not being increased, like it is, even in line with inflation, it doesn't actually meet the required or the desired outcomes that we're aiming for. So we know, as an example, in many countries which have implemented a strong and progressive health promotion levy, that we have seen decline, it be Chile, it be in the UK, that they actually it can yield positive results.
I understand where you're coming from, but the sugar industry counters you and says all of this threatens jobs. So how do you respond to workers who fear losing their livelihoods because of the higher levy that you're proposing?
I think we're on the side of the workers. We're on the side of the working class. We're on the side of black women who are producing, sugar cane, right? I think the conversation currently is not very productive in our view, because it pits us against each other, right? We want same outcome. We want sustainable jobs, right? We want, you know, a healthy country as well. I think we should spin off the conversation and look at how do we actually transform the sugar industry in a way that is sustainable, because it's not sustainable to want to feed the population with sugar dense content of food at the expense of sustaining jobs. There are ways, countries at BRICS, we're not talking about richer nations, we can talk about India and Brazil, they have done it. And I think we should move this conversation towards that on how do we support livelihoods in a way that is healthy, in the way that is productive, because tomorrow the risk, Jeremy, is the tobacco industry can say the same thing, alcohol industry can say the same thing. And then how do we then choose the battle of protecting people's health, you know, and balancing act of actually sustaining jobs? And I think that is the conversation that we should
so
be having.
So what is your solution? How do you transform the sugar industry?
I think we transform the sugar industry by actually government, in terms of even the plans that they've put to support, you know, the industry, in terms of the use of sugar into biofuel, which is a booming industry, and actually do away more and more in terms of wanting, you know, the sugar demand into the consumption, in terms of the food and sugary drinks. And I think that is doable. We've seen it with the BRICS nations, that we are actually sort of our equals in terms of developing and emerging economies. So I think we need to move that. We need to work with trade unions. We need to work with government. We need to work with these communities. We need to work with KZN. We need to work with Mpumalanga. We need to work with civil society, because there are practical solutions in the medium and long term that we can actually move this conversation away from pitting it against each other.
So when you take your proposals to government, do they listen to you or do they laugh at you?
I think because, you know, government sometimes have a tendency of thinking civil society and communities are not forming part of the backbone of the state, right, in terms of state actors. And I think for me, up to this now, I would say I think they are laughing at us, because this conversation should evolve and it should bring all sectors of society, right, and including the sugar industry, and have a conversation that speaks to the current problem, the current crisis of diabetes that we have, and how do we resolve this without actually, you know, harming them, and move away from the conversation of us and them, because we are one society. Even the workers themselves need to pitch at work. If they are unhealthy, then that will also still cost them in terms of the economy. So we think we need to get to that point.
I'm interested to read that you claim there is industry interference ahead of the budget. What do you mean by that? How much lobbying pressure is being applied behind closed doors right now? And there's a difference between lobbying and interference, isn't there?
Yes. So lobbying is allowed. So even the work that we do does include lobbying. That is convincing, you know, with evidence that this policy, you know, is important, or this regulation is important, or this legislature is important. But I think the problem is doing things behind closed doors. And we know as a fact that there's a cluster that was formed with the Department of Agriculture, with Trade and Industry, with Treasury and the Department of Health to look at the health promotion levy. The problem is in that lobbying, that gathering doesn't have transparency, doesn't have the voices of civil society, right? In terms of not just arguing that, you know, the sugar industry must be beaten down, but in terms of looking at practical solutions. But again, there's no transparency in sharing in terms of public, because we have asked from Treasury that, you know, we know that you have met with the sugar industry. Can you share, you know, in terms of public access to information, what came out of those meetings? And that has not been forthcoming.
Thank you very much indeed. It'll be very interesting to see how this particular issue plays out. I've been in conversation with Nzama Mbalati, who's Chief Executive Officer of the Healthy Living Alliance.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's love affair with affordable cars, I think, is shifting from where they come from, where they originate. And that shift has big implications for local manufacturing, for jobs, and probably the future of the auto industry. Listen to this number. Nearly half of all passenger vehicles sold here now come from India, raising questions about whether South African plants can keep pace or risk deindustrialization. This is an important issue as far as South Africa's economy is concerned. Let's throw a little bit more light onto it. I'm joined by Andrew Hibbard, who is a data analyst at Lightstone Auto. Andrew, this is interesting. A dramatic rise in vehicles imported from India. Maybe let's start with this. How big a shift are we talking about, say, compared to 5-10 years ago?
Thanks, Jeremy. So over the last 10-15 years, I suppose, we've seen a number of the imported vehicle volume from India increasing to the extent where in 2025 this was running at about 38% of all local light vehicles, so that's passenger and light commercial vehicles, were sold that came from India. The key thing here is that obviously we've seen a number of non-Indian brands beginning to import vehicles from India over that time frame. So whereas in 2010, there was one brand that imported, non-Indian brand that imported more than 1,000 units from India. Last year, there were five of these brands. And that includes your Toyotas, Suzukis, Hyundais, Renault, all brands that you would expect to be coming from elsewhere.
Is it purely, Andrew, a price play, or are there other factors that are contributing, do you think?
I think there's a large portion that can be attributed to economies of scale in terms of production of a certain type of vehicle in India. But at the end of the day, I think motor car manufacturers are out to ensure that they are competitive from a price perspective. And to a large extent, the brands that are bringing vehicles in from India do not have production facilities in South Africa at present.
So how much of that import growth then is Indian versus other markets that you've already referenced, for instance, like China, that is also starting to accelerate its presence, isn't it?
They are, but the difference between China and India is that most of the imports coming from China are Chinese brands. Mm. So where we see the growth in imported vehicle sales from China, that is by and large Chinese brands that are driving those vehicle sales. Whereas India, as I said, it's non-Indian brands.
Fair to say that price isn't everything. Do you have a sense then, Andrew, as to how these Indian imports stack up on quality, on safety, maybe even after-sales support compared to locally manufactured cars?
I think that at the way that the world is moving these days in terms of safety and desire for those kinds of features within vehicles, I think that vehicles, pretty much all vehicles coming into South Africa at the moment are reasonably competitive in terms of what they're offering the consumer.
So let's look at consequence and impact then for the local industry. Should this trend be seen as a threat? Is it a wake-up call? Or maybe somewhere there's an opportunity? I don't know.
So the key thing to remember, so if we're looking at the at the entry, I think a large portion of the Indian market, or the Indian vehicles coming from the Indian market, are entering the South African market with focus on consumers looking for vehicles at, say, under 500,000 rand. Mm. This large portion of the South African production, whereas 10 years ago, 15 years ago, that was potentially 50% of locally produced vehicles were designated for sale in South Africa. That's changed over that time frame, to the extent that where we see now is, you know, around 30% of locally produced vehicles are sold here, whereas the rest are exported. Now, what that does tend to show is there's a definite move in terms of our local production, which essentially has been relatively stable over the last 10 years, only with some COVID impacts. Local production has topped 500,000 vehicles, light vehicles, every year since 2011. So production has stayed relatively stable, but the demand, or the target of where those vehicles are ending up, is obviously changing slightly, with a large number now being pushed into the export market. And this is can be attributed to a number of things, including preferences, local preferences in terms of body shape and what those production facilities are making, as well as how manufacturers globally have adjusted their production strategies.
But it does have implications, surely, for the South African Automotive Master Plan, particularly when it comes to localization and jobs, surely. It seems to me that local manufacturers would remain on the back foot for some time.
Jeremy, it really comes down to what the OEM, the manufacturer's strategies are moving forward. Obviously, they need to understand where their economies of scale lie, where they're going to make their improve their opportunities in terms of their manufacturing strategy. They obviously need to have some sort of plan in place to ensure that they can move their export vehicles relatively seamlessly around the globe. And to a large extent, there is potentially going to be some impact, but what that impact might be remains to be seen.
Is there any way that this trend that you've outlined to us maybe drives investment into local EV manufacturing, or maybe even to incentivize technology transfer to South Africa? Could that be a positive?
It would be a positive. Obviously, there's been a lot of talk in the media and around industry organizations to try and encourage some sort of incentive around new energy vehicle production. There are a number of the manufacturers who currently are engaging in producing hybrid and plug-in hybrid vehicles in South Africa. But obviously, if we get buy-in from high up the food chain, it would incentivize the entire process.
I really appreciate that assessment. Andrew Hibbert, data analyst, Lightstone Auto. Thank you so much for your time today. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let's move on to education now. And an 88% matric pass rate is, I think, real progress, and it deserves some recognition. But headline numbers, I also think, can hide uncomfortable truths about who never makes it to matric in the first place. From early literacy gaps to the sharp drop-off in grade 9, and that's a real problem in South Africa, the education pipeline in this country is still leaking badly. I want to discuss that in a little more detail. Graham Wilkinson is with me, Senior Social Investment Specialist at Chikalulu Social Investments. Graham, all very well and good, the country celebrating an 88% matric pass rate, but from a social investment perspective, what does that number get right, do you think, and what does it more importantly hide?
Oh, thanks, Jeremy. And what that number is showing us is that there are definite improvements in the system. As a country, we should be celebrating, particularly with our colleagues who are in the Department of Education and in the various provinces that have been working very hard for many years to be able to get matrics through their you know, important milestone of getting their national senior certificate. And to have for the third year in a row, to kind of hit a hat-trick, to have a class that beats the previous year's record is fantastic. That's showing that there is some resilience to what is being built by the various, you know, we've got 10 departments of education, the national plus 9 provincial departments, and they, you know, there's some healthy competition between them to see who's going to, you know, hit those highlights from year to year, and that's really driving some real improvements in the number of learners who are getting through and passing their national. senior certificate. And so there is much to be celebrated there. We are, especially in the context of South Africa, where we've got many instances where the state and the administrative power of the state is not as strong as we'd like it to be. Here we have some state officials that are really putting their shoulders to the wheel and getting on with the work. But as we've been saying, and it's also thanks to many social investors who rallied around and helped to support that work. And there's some fantastic examples in various provinces. We could think of different foundations and funds that have done specific work to support the matric results. And I think the result is because, as a country, we've rallied around this cause. But as you say, it is hiding some other things. It's not giving the full picture.
One of the big problems that I understand, Graham, is that at grade 9, pass rates drop sharply. Explain to me why this stage is emerging as one of the most dangerous pressure points in the system, if my description is correct.
Yes, I would concur that that is a dangerous pressure point, and I'm basing that on looking at the numbers. And the one number that we've been very interested to look at over the last few years, because we don't have, there were an attempt to introduce an annual national assessment at grade 3, grade 6, and grade 9 within the education system, and those were withdrawn. So we don't have a national result equivalent to the national senior certificate results, the matric results, for other grades. But what we do have is the general household survey that Stats South Africa does. And we can see that over the years, the number of 10 and 11-year-olds who have passed grade 3 has increased from, it used to be 75-78% two decades ago. So it's taken us 20 years to get to a point where 94% of 10-year-olds have passed grade 3. That suggests that they might have had to repeat maybe 1 or 2 years, because you should be 9 years of age when you're in grade 3. But okay, it's great to see that the vast majority, almost 94% have grade 3. That drops to 75% of 16-year-olds who have grade 9. So that's a quarter almost. It's a quarter of people, of 16-year-olds who don't have grade 9 by the time they turn 17. That cohort of people, a quarter of 16-year-olds in the country don't have grade 9, which means their opportunities for advancement, whether it's in an academic or a vocational stream, are curtailed.
And compounding the problem, even fewer pass mathematics and fewer still complete post-school qualifications. But it's the mathematics, the STEM subjects, that is of perpetual concern. And this does remain a big constraint on South Africa's future economy, does it not?
Absolutely. And we can see the signs of that already at grade 3, which is where many social investors are now beginning to focus their attention. Many of our clients at Chikululu are getting behind a foundation phase investment. So that's grade 1, grade 2, grade 3, because another result we do have access to is a national assessment of the ability of those in grade 4 to read for meaning. And the shocking result is that 80% of those would be 10-year-olds, are not able to read for meaning in any language after 3 or 4 years of school. So they are getting through grade 3, but the quality of the education is obviously not to standard. So a lot of effort is being put on supporting foundation phase literacy and numeracy. If we can get that right, of course, by grade 9, hopefully, learners able to read for themselves is numerate, would be better placed to tackle maths and to tackle those subjects that you're just the STEM subjects that you've mentioned. So there is a recognition that it starts in the early years. What I'm arguing is that we also need to be building real alternative pathways for grade 9s. Something like we used to have that old junior certificate, which you could then take to go to a TVET or a college.
Yeah.
But people aren't leaving at grade 9 with their JC because the TVET and the college options are not that enticing, frankly. You've got better prospects if you try and push our hand for matric and try and get into university. But as a country, we need plumbers, we need tradespeople, we need the doers. And the pathways to train doers with those skills are just not real options for someone leading grade 9 at the moment. So the incentives for them to do well in grade 9 are just not other than the matric result, you know, the academic stream, alternative options just are not real. And that's perhaps where social investors could start looking at putting their investments going.
Well, let me finish with that then. If you had to direct a lump sum of money, of social investment money, what point in the education pipeline do you think is then going to deliver the biggest long-term impact and why?
Yeah, so absolutely. The evidence is definitely, it's showing that investing in children being able to read for meaning, to have their way around numbers, to be numerate by grade four, is the best bang for your buck as an investor. Yeah. Because the learner is able to read for themselves going forward. But it helps make every successive teacher that they encounter on their journey, their job a lot easier, to have a child who's literate and numerate and is able to build on the work that is done from year to year. And that would also help us, of course, have better informed voters, citizens, etc. That can only but augur well for the economy going forward.
Right. Thank you very much for a healthy dose of reality there, post the matric results. Graham Wilkinson from Chickalulu Social Investments, appreciate your time today. Thank you. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.